Man, what a brave guy to step up here and have to read a passage with all those names. That was good, wasn't it? That was good. Welcome to Babylon. We are starting a new series on this amazing book. If you're new to Genesis or a guest, we're really glad you're here. And one of the things that we do intentionally here is that most of our preaching here is through books of the Bible. We believe that God has clearly spoken through the book that we're reading, that he has made himself, revealed himself to us, and that the reading of the Bible and interaction with the Bible is listening to the voice of God. And so most of our preaching, not all of it, sometimes we do series that are more topical, but most of our preaching, we just start with the book and take it through. And I'm excited about this book right now because I think it speaks to us. It is set in ancient history, but it speaks to us in our moment and teaches us how to live maybe as exiles. Now, I want to tell you about a season of my life where I was an exile. My wife and I were newly married, here's some things you need to know about me. I'm an outdoorsman, so I don't mind wearing camouflage, but there really isn't an ounce of redneck in me, okay? I know I drive a pickup truck, but that's about as far as it goes, okay? Hunting and driving a pickup, it's about as far as a redneck goes. I think country music is an oxymoron. I don't speak with a twang, and when I talk fast, I don't start sounding like a banjo, okay? It's just not there. I'm not a redneck. And so God, in his glory, grace, and sense of humor, the first church that I was actually full-time as a pastoral leader was in a church in a little bitty small town called California, Missouri. Which, it's funny because I talk to people and say, well, you know, while I lived in California and their eyes get big, I'm like, Missouri. They're like, oh, I'm sorry. I lived in a small town in California, Missouri. And what was really interesting, when we moved there, I immediately realized I had a problem. I didn't fit in. I actually didn't understand the language. When this family came, like the people from the church came to move us, they were going to move us out of our apartment into a place that we were going to live in California, Missouri. They showed up with a horse trailer. True story. And as the guy, they were talking to us, the guy looked at me, and he said this. He looked at me, and this one guy said, "Design." And I said, "Excuse me?" He said, "Design." And I froze like a deer in the headlights. I'm like, I don't know what he's saying. My brother-in-law, who is a redneck, put his hand on my shoulder, and he's saying, "Mike, he's asking you if you sing." I was like, oh, yes, I sing a little bit. I need a translator. I didn't understand the language. We got there, and I did not fit in. My wife, who grew up on a farm, they thought she was wonderful. I was this fast-talking city boy who just never connected in that town. Now, teenagers there, I was overseeing youth ministry. I had a great relationship with teenagers. But to the day that I left, most of the adults in that church looked at me like an outsider who was to be looked at as a little bit of trouble, right? And it was kind of awkward and uncomfortable. And I had to figure out how to love Jesus and serve the Lord there. The Lord actually taught me a lot about living in what, for me, felt like a foreign culture. Well, what we're looking at is a story about four guys, really, in the book of Daniel, who are going to be forced to live in exile. They're going to be put in a place that is not their home, ripped out of their own country, and put in a place that is not their home. They're going to serve under a king who doesn't have their beliefs, a kingdom who is going to claim sovereignty over their lives. But as the kingdom claims sovereignty of their lives, they're going to wrestle with what it looks like to love the kingdom of God while they live in a kingdom of this world. They're going to figure out what it looks like to be a citizen of Jerusalem while they also are going to live as citizens of Babylon. And here's why it's important. In our culture, those of us who follow Jesus are finding more and more that we are moving to a situation where we are losing our place of privilege. And we're going to find ourselves, if we have authentic faith in Jesus Christ, we're going to find that we are more and more in a culture who not only doesn't like our beliefs, but is going to marginalize us, is going to try to silence our voice, is going to try to put us in a corner, and more than that, is going to challenge us and try to force us to bow our knee to a foreign king, to give our belief in Christ away so that we can fit into the culture. And so what we're going to find is that we are going to be much and much more like, much and much more like the Christians who have always lived in every other place in the world, Christians who have lived in almost every other time in the world, The American experiment is part of something that came out of Europe that you need to understand. We live in a culture, or lived in a culture, and I really think it's past tense, where the culture as a whole was built on Christian ideals and the belief system that is Christianity. Not necessarily the gospel, but the belief system that is Christianity found a place of favor in our culture, so much so that in some places, people who absolutely rejected Christianity felt like they had to do things like join a church and be a member of a church so they could do business in a community. Heard that story this week about somebody who literally has a hardened, he despises Christians and Christianity because he had to live a fake life in Texas because the only way he was going to be able to run a business in Texas is to show up at church every week. And he never believed in Jesus, but the only way to fit in was to see, that's a culture that was sympathetic with Christian ideals and marginalized people who didn't hold those. And that's kind of the way America has been for a long, long time. Didn't mean that churches were filled with authentically Christian people. It meant that people knew how to be culturally Christian. And here's what's happening, is that is shifting, and it's actually shifting at the speed of light. Something happened this past week that caught my attention immediately, last week and a half or so, caught my attention immediately, and I went, this is really interesting. And it was around our vice president and his wife. Now, don't hear this as support for any political position. It was the issue that happened. As our culture, it started with a CNN article that got picked up by BBC across the water, but then was fed and written on by multiple people, and it was this, that the wife of our vice president went back to her job. But her job was as an art teacher at a Christian school. And so she went back to her job. But what happened is the way it was portrayed, the way it was shared in all of the news is that she, by taking a position in this Christian setting, just the mere fact that that school held authentic Christian beliefs that have been held by Christians for 2,000 years. You need to understand that the belief system that we're talking about is the belief system that we have here, that just merely holding the beliefs that are set forth in the scriptures and have been believed by believers, by people for 2,000 years, made her a bigot. We are there. It went crazy. Uh-oh, we've lost power in here. And there it comes back on. Yeah, I know, that's... got this side. There comes that side. All right. And is the sound back on? All right. We have lost, we are quickly losing this place of privilege and being moved to a place where we are going to and already are finding ourselves as exiles. And this is what you need to know. Your kids are already there. Your kids in the schools they go to, the colleges, universities they will be heading to, it will not be a place where they're really preaching tolerance so that all beliefs can have a place. It is more and more tolerance that is going to be preached in such a way that if you hold authentic Christian faith, authentic Christian beliefs, we are going to tell you that you must leave that at the door and actually bow to a different system, a different way of seeing the world. You must give yourself over to it. If we are not preparing our kids to live as exiles, we are not serving them well. Right? Okay, now, lest I freak everybody out right now, Daniel's going to help us a lot, because the tendency when we start hearing this, and I'm letting you know right now what we need to fight against, is the tendency when we start hearing this is we start going like this. And that is not Daniel. That is not Daniel. What we're going to find is four men who serve a king and a kingdom well. They just will not let that king and kingdom become supreme in them. What does it look like to live as exiles? We need to be prepared for that. We need to realize that this is where we're going. It is where our culture is moving. It is where Christians everywhere in the world have lived. And it's actually one of the biggest biblical themes in all of the Bible. We see the biblical theme of exile beginning in the garden where Adam and Eve in their rebellion against God, their sin, are sent away from their true home into a larger world that is broken and fallen. It's not the way it should be. Then God calls and rescues and redeems a people, delivers them from slavery, and he gives them a home. But they live in a way for almost 1,000 years live in a way where they ignore their relationship with God. And God had saved them. He's rescued them in the book of Exodus to have a people on the earth that are his. But the reason God rescued the Hebrew people, the Old Testament Hebrew people, and made them a nation that were his was so that throughout time he would have a representation of himself on, planet. Okay? It's freaking me out up here. Like, are they coming after me because I'm talking? That God's purpose was to give a representation of himself in the earth. So the world could look at Israel and see who the true living God was by the way he shaped the lives of the people. But their response to that was to become arrogant, become bold, and to embrace the gods of all the nations. So literally they would go give sacrifice on Saturday, which is their day of worship, and the rest of the week they would embrace the values, the culture, the systems, the idolatry of the nations around them. And God started sending them prophets. Prophets would say, listen, we have a good God. He loves us. He has rescued us. He is for us. He has redeemed us. He has made us his people. We are special because of who our God is, but we are running from him, and God cannot allow this to go on indefinitely. And now for a couple hundred years, there have been prophets who've been predicting the rise of this one nation, this one leader, this one king, predicting the fall of Jerusalem, predicting the danger that was coming that was literally at the hand of God. And prophets who even named these kings by name, some of them before they were born. And Israel and the kings and leaders and rulers of the nation just kept going, I don't want to hear it. I'm going to live how I want to. And there's a verse in Chronicles that's one of the most sobering verses in the Bible, the very end of 2 Chronicles, that is telling the history of Israel. It says, God kept sending the prophets, but as the prophets proclaimed to his people, this is why it's important. They're not yelling at the world. They're shouting at the redeemed people of God, saying, we must repent because we are here to prove, to show the world who God is. As they said, the nation of Israel kept taking them, arresting them, killing them, harassing them, and ignoring their message. And this is the phrase it says. It says, God sent the prophets until the point that there was no remedy. Oh, may we never get to the point where the beauty and the grace of God, the kindness of the Lord in our hearts doesn't lead us to repentance. And God brings me and you and his people here in this town and in this church and in our country to the point where God says, listen, there's no remedy. They're hard and distant. And so what God does is the storyline of the Bible includes this period of history that is called the Babylonian exile. This is the setting. Look at verses 1 and 2 again. It says, in the third year of the reign of King Jehoiakim, king of Judah, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came to Jerusalem and besieged it. And the Lord gave Jehoiakim, the king of Judah, into the hand, and some of the vessels of the house of God, and he brought to them to the land of Shinar, to the house of his God, and placed the vessels in the treasury of his God. Here's what happens in the storyline, that Nebuchadnezzar is the leader at this point in time of this empire that is growing. Eventually, the Babylonian Empire will rule the Middle Eastern and Western world, the known world at that time in Western culture. Eventually, they will reign everything from basically Italy to India, everything in between, everything that we know of as the Middle East, and even down into Egypt, they will rule. Nebuchadnezzar, in 605 BC, has this battle where he battles Pharaoh Necho. There's words, there'll be a quiz at the end, you got to know the answers, right? Pharaoh Necho of Egypt, and there's a battle called the Battle of Carchemish. And the reason I'm throwing this out is that if you were to go take a world history right now, you would study the Battle of Carchemish and the fall of Egypt to the Babylonians. King Nebuchadnezzar is victorious. Carchemish is just a little bit north of Israel. And what has happened is King Jehoiakim had thrown his weight behind Necho. He saw Babylon as a threat. But the prophets kept telling him, man, don't do that. Don't make alliances with Egypt. This is God's hand. This is what God's doing. And Jehoiakim looked at the prophet and said, I don't care what you say. This is the best political solution. He joined sides with Necho, and here comes Babylon. Babylon defeats Egypt. Egypt flees, and he's going to drive all the way through. One of the interesting things you need to know when you read the Bible is that God, the promised land that God gave his people in the Old Testament, this land that we now call Israel, in the Bible it's called the land of Canaan. It's been called Palestine, this plot of ground. In the ancient world is the single most important plot of real estate on the planet that we call home earth. It is the single most important real estate, and here's why. If you are a king and you want to conquer anybody, you got to conquer Israel first, because it is the gateway, it is the pathway to everywhere. If you want to go from the north in like modern-day Iraq, known as Babylon or Persia, and you want to get to Egypt, you had to go through Israel. If you want to get from Iraq and get to Europe, if you went straight across, you were going through a desert that would kill your army. So guess what? You went south and then came back north, and you came through what is known as Israel. If you want to go from south and go to north and try to conquer, you went through Israel. You had to rule Israel if you were going to rule everybody else. And so over and over and over again, this little plot of ground that is the plot of ground God gave his people becomes the focal point of battles, of situations, and here they are again. And Jehoiakim kind of rebelled against what God had told him through the prophets, but now Nebuchadnezzar has won, and now Nebuchadnezzar comes into the city of Jerusalem, and Jehoiakim has to bow his knee to King Nebuchadnezzar. And we have the beginning of what is called the Babylonian exile. What will happen is, starting in 605 BC, the exile will last exactly 70 years to 535 BC, and we'll see how that is beautiful next week as we look at a prophecy from Jeremiah where he says this is going to go on for 70 years. And it happened from the first day King Nebuchadnezzar showed up to the day that the Hebrews went home. It was like not 69 and a quarter years. It was exactly 70 years. God is sovereign. That's the point of this message. But in the midst of it, Nebuchadnezzar comes in 605 BC, and what happens the first time Nebuchadnezzar shows up with his armies and his kingdom in Israel is he deports a few people. That's what's going on here. Daniel and his friends that we're going to be talking about are among the first deportees, where they take the nobility, they take people who are in the king's household, they go grab the people who are going to Ivy League schools. So like they came in town, they would go find the best and brightest who are going to wash you. And they take those people away in the first time. A few years later, about 8 years later, in 597 BC, King Jehoiakim mysteriously dies. We don't really know how, but most scholars believe that there was some kind of assassination that was at the hands of Nebuchadnezzar. But eventually, Nebuchadnezzar puts a second king in play, or another king rises up who kind of says, come on, we're going to side with Egypt. And Nebuchadnezzar comes a second time and ramshacks the city, and now he deports a lot more people, including grabbing that king, putting a ring through his nose, and dragging him across the desert with a ring through his nose. It's awful. This is not a good moment. And then the next phase, in 586 BC, Nebuchadnezzar shows up a third time because the following king, who also bows his neck, a guy named Hezekiah bows his neck, and that king, this time Nebuchadnezzar shows up, and the third time the armies of Babylon show up in Israel, they not only defeat Israel, but they destroy the walls of the city. They besiege it and they knock the walls down. They come through and they destroy and set fire to everything in the city, and they destroy the temple built by Solomon in the Old Testament. They absolutely destroy the temple, the central place of worship. And now everybody who lives in Jerusalem and the surrounding area is either dead, they have fled to the hills, or they are forced to march about 900 miles across what is, much of it is desert and arid country, to end up in Babylon, where they will live for the next, some of them it will be 70 years, some of them less, but the next generation of people will live in Babylon, where they will have to figure out what it looks like to live under a different kingdom. But their God is their God. How does all this happen? And the wrestling with this. And here comes Daniel and his four friends, who become front and center in this book, who become a picture, a representative in the Babylonian exile of how to live as exiles. Now, why do I give you all that history? Because we woke up this morning, some of us have very hard lives. There's a lot of brokenness in the world. We struggle, and we have the same struggles, the same questions. And we are finding ourselves in a culture where we're going to have to wrestle with, what are we going to do here? How are we going to live in this world? If I have I have to get up and go to work. And for many of us, our place of employment is a place where the tension of living in as an exile is becoming more and more real. We go to school, and the tension of living as an exile, and the question that we are constantly having to wrestle with is, who's really sovereign, and in the midst of who's sovereign in my life, like, what am I going to do to try to fit here while I really try to serve a different king? And some people will just say, listen, we're just giving in, we're just going the other direction. Other people will draw lines and become angry towards the culture, and neither one of those are okay. And I think at the heart of this, the big theme of Daniel has to be the backdrop for everything else we see in the book. These are not hero stories. We've turned them into hero stories, and we will talk about the way Daniel and his friends respond to certain things, but the central message of this book is not to look at Daniel and see Captain America, right? The hero who has the shield, who you know, battles. That's not what's going on. The central message of the book is about the sovereignty of God in a place where it feels like the culture and the people around us feel sovereign. They're going to live as exiles. And so how do we do this? How do we live in this culture? How do we live in this situations, living in exile? And here's what happens, is that every culture around us, especially when the culture is growing in hostility or has hostility, every culture sets itself up as supreme. It tells us that it is going to rule our lives and that we must bow. And it warns us of promises that will happen if we don't. We see this in the text, and we're hearing this now in the language of our culture. I can't tell you the number of times I've heard about certain issues, certain challenges, certain things where holding authentic Christian beliefs, we're being told that we are on the wrong side of history. Have you heard that language? That we are on the wrong side, like to believe this and to stand for this and to hold these beliefs, to believe in who Christ is and what he claimed, the claim he is making on my life, that we are literally standing on the wrong side of history. That is a warning with some promises that is coming, and it's just like here. Look at these. First promise that the threat of living in exile brings us, the threat that is coming towards us, that is very real in our life, that our kids feel this, is the promise of pain. Verse 1 tells us that the king of Babylon came to Jerusalem and besieged it. The Lord gave Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hands. So now there is defeat, there is overthrow of their country. And then the king commanded, verse 3, Asphanaz, the chief eunuch, to bring some people of Israel, both the royal family and the nobility. Here's what's going on. They intentionally grabbed young men who woke up one morning in their country thinking their God was the supreme God, that they were in good shape, and had allegiance to King Jehoiakim, and woke up one morning, see their country fall, and now they are being deported and forced to live in a foreign culture. It's awful. Don't lose the weight of this awful moment, what it means for these four men. Don't turn them into some kind of mythical figures. Feel the weight of being ripped from your home and forced to live, not choosing to move, being forced to live in a place that you don't want to go, and being persecuted and being having the culture around you like have a foreign language, a foreign culture, everything about it is different, and definitely foreign gods. And what happens is that a culture will look at us and go, listen, if you will just give in, you can believe what you want to, go to church, it's fine. Just when you enter our space, don't hold anything you believe in, or, listen, you will suffer. You will be persecuted. It's going to go hard for you. It's going to go bad for you. It's not going to work. And we hear that call. Our kids hear that call. Listen, if I actually believe what you're telling me to believe, and I live based on those beliefs, it is not going to go well for me here. The culture also, a culture that is, when we live in exile, is also promises us powerlessness. They're dragged away. There's nothing they can do. One of the things I think that we have to be very careful about, coming from a culture where the Christian ideals had a level of power in our culture, So now we're losing that. Is that the central goal for us is to reclaim that power. That may not make sense to you, but I hope you understand what I'm saying. That often what's, and really what's going on in a lot of our culture right now with Christianity, those who are in Christian leadership, is that we are trying to reclaim the power that we feel we are losing as the highest goals, as if Christians in power means that there will be more Christians. That is not true. We are finding that tons of people are leaving the church now that it is culturally acceptable not to be a Christian. It was always a false system and a false set of beliefs for many people anyway. But what we do is we try to grab power because we know if we have power, we're safe. We're not going to be persecuted. People can't speak against us. And so we think the most important thing, don't mishear me. I'm not saying these things are necessarily bad. The most important thing is if we have the right Supreme Court, everything will be okay. Right? As if the Supreme Court was a sufficient replacement for the God that we serve and worship. They are not. And I hope they make good decisions that are based on the Imago Dei and the creation of every human being in the image of God and those sorts of things. But you need to hear me. The ultimate win in our culture is not the right person in the White House and the right people on the Supreme Court. The ultimate win in our culture is authentic Christian lives of people who believe in King Jesus no matter what's going on around us. And maybe if we understand God is sovereign, powerlessness might be a good thing for us. But the culture is going to tell us, listen, you will be powerless. You will have no control. We are taking what is ours. The last is the promise of prosperity. Now, this is very interesting. Look at what happens in the story. Look down at verse 5. The king assigned them a daily portion of the food that the king ate and of the wine that he drank. And they were to be educated for 3 years, and at the end of that time, they were to stand before the king. Listen to the draw. Listen, I know you've been ripped from your homeland. I know you have your belief system. I know you have your king, but here's what we're going to do. We're going to put you in the university. We're going to put you in the University of Babylon. Now, most scholars believe that at this point in time, Daniel is probably 14 or 15 years old. Listen, that is the age of my son, Josiah. It's probably the age of Daniel. We're going to put you in the university, and here's what we're going to do. We're going to put Chaldean, Babylonian literature in front of you so that we can indoctrinate you, because we're going to figure out who among you is the brightest, the best, because here's what we want to do. We want you to stand before the king. We want you to be Jewish enough, but Jewish in a way that you embrace Babylon so that when everybody else comes, you can stand before everybody. This is the goal that they have for them. They want to take Hebrew leaders, the elites, the cultural leaders, they want to create spokesmen who will stand before the Hebrews and go, you know what, Babylon is not that bad. If we just cater this, we just betray this, if we just turn on this, and here's what they do. They say, we're going to bring you in front of the king, we're going to give you prime rib every night. We're going to feed you steak. We're going to give you the king's food. You will prosper. Listen, if you will just lay aside, listen, be Hebrew, that's cool, but also embrace Babylonian and what it means to be part of us. Embrace our gods, our religion, our system. Just kind of mix it together. But what we want is we want you to be our spokesperson who will stand before your people as they show up and say, you know what, we can live in this country. And we can kind of believe in our God over here, but the rest of the time we can just embrace their culture. We can embrace their beliefs. We don't have to live as exiles. We can live as Babylonians. That's the goal of this text. And we hear that our kids hear the same thing. Listen, if you'll just embrace this, you will be rich, you will be prosperous, the culture will bless you, but if you don't, you will lose everything. This has always been the battle cry of a culture speaking to exiles. This is the battle cry. If you were to move and become a Christian in North Korea right now, the power of this would be intense. We will make you hurt, we will take away your power, and you will own nothing. But if you'll just give in, we promise, we will make you prosperous, it will all go good. It is the battle cry in the Middle East among regimes who are rejecting the God of the Bible and in a different type of religion taking a stand where they're looking at Christians saying, we will persecute you, we will take away your power, and in the end, you will lose everything. But if you will just give in a little bit, if you will just play ball, in the end, you will get everything you want. Your lives will go good. It is the persecution that has gone on for centuries, And the language of this, and I want you to, like, I hope during this series you will start hearing it. This is the language that is growing more and more bold on CNN, on MSNBC, in some ways even on Fox. It is growing more and more bold among people in our political process, but it's been going on in our education for years. So what do we do? Like, I know I've got you freaked out this morning, right? What do we do? We read Daniel, and we find the themes, because what happens is that people in this situation, they're going to have two big questions. The first one is, if God is true, then why? Like, I think I know the one true and living God, but why did this happen? And we feel that weight all the time, and it's not just necessarily because we live as exiles. We wake up and we find out we have cancer. We find out we lost a job. We struggle with kids who are hurting, and then maybe even kids who deny the gospel, and we go, God, if like, I read the Bible, I believe this, all this, but if you are true, then why? And what Babylon's going to say is, the reason is because your God is not the ultimate God. We are. But we wrestle with, why did this happen? Which leads to question number two, if God, our God is true, how should we live in Babylon? And that becomes the question. I hope what will happen in this series is that there will be a lot of points where you look at who you are as a student, young people, and think, man, what does it look like to live in Babylon as a student? A lot of you, your workplace is a place where this is growing more and more real. And I hope there's some real practical ideas that say, how do we live in Babylon when my workplace really has embraced these ideals and all the training and all the things they're doing is really confronting what I've held to believe as a follower of Jesus. We're going to find more and more that the cultural marketplace is growing, and how do we interact with that? And I hope this series will take us to real practical, real life things that we can say, man, this is how this looks in my life. And for those of you who are like, the idea of Christianity is foreign, and you're not sure, like even today you feel like I'm kind of preaching a us versus them message. I just hope that you'll come next week and hear me flat out say, this is not us versus them. It's not. That is not the book of Daniel. It is not us versus them. It is us for them. That God is saving, like he is doing the same thing he has always done, and that is this. God is redeeming a people and filling them with his goodness and grace and pouring his spirit into them so that in Babylon they will shine. He will give a representation of his character through the lives of his people who live in Babylon. Our goal is not to convince Babylon to live like Christians. It is to be authentic followers of Jesus in Babylon. That has always been our call. We've just lived in a culture where we're not sure what that looks like because everybody kind of believes what we do. And hear this, your kids are going to have this message embedded in them because somebody had to teach Daniel so that when he was ripped away at 14, he shows up, he already knew what he believed and he knew what he was going to stand for, and so did his friends. We don't find Daniel's parents in the story, but somebody prepared he and his friends for this moment. Mom and dad, that's our job. Right? That's why we're doing this new city catechism. Listen, don't just do this on Sunday with us. Please don't just see this as something. Start embedding these things into your children. Open the Bible and read it. Pour into them. Because, listen, when they're 18, they go away to college. You need to know that even some places are Christian school, but if they go to a secular school, there is no doubt that this is going on in full force on the secular college campus. And that does not mean we shouldn't go there. Means we should. But they better be ready. They better be ready. And that is not, it's not Blevins' job to do that. It's not Eureka High School's job. It's our job. And so there is this wrestling with, and so what happens? We start reading Daniel and we see that the first half of the book are these pretty amazing stories of Daniel and his four friends begin to stand in this culture in a way that they're living for the good of the culture, but there are moments where the culture says, you must bow your knee here, you must kneel, you must give up your beliefs, you cannot pray anymore. And in the midst of this, we have these amazing stories that include a fiery furnace, a lion's den, right? Hence the lions on the stage. There are points where Babylon says, to remain here, you must give up what you believe and bow. And it's at those points where Daniel and his friends say, we can't do that. But they never get angry at the Babylonians because they did bow. It's their difference that is the beauty of the story, right? And yes, in these situations, God delivers them, but that doesn't mean he always will. There's been millions of people through history who have stood for the gospel, and when they got thrown to the lions, they got eaten. When they were thrown in the furnace, they died. And God is still faithful. And he is still accomplishing his purpose. He is still good. And so the second half of the book then gets really weird. Because starting with chapter 7, we have these crazy apocalyptic visions that pull us away from these four individuals to all of history. And so the theme of Daniel, this is what's going on. The whole theme of Daniel is this. It is showing us that I woke up this morning and feel like my life is falling apart, that things are hard, that my kids are a mess, that I live in a broken world, that maybe I'm a single parent and why is all this happening to me? Or maybe I'm in a job situation where it feels like if I don't cater, I'm going to lose my job, or I'm definitely not going to have the prosperity I think I want. And the path is difficult. And I go, God, where are you? And in the midst of that, we are living in a world where we see political regimes and kingdoms who feel like if God is real, how can this guy be in power? And if God is real, how can this be going on? And if God is real, how can this sort of decision be made in our culture that goes against everything that the Bible teaches? How do we, like, we see regimes and powers that feel sovereign, and all of a sudden my boss feels sovereign, the culture feels sovereign, the president feels sovereign, the situation I'm in feels sovereign, that the control of my life and the control of the whole world, it feels like it's in the hands of people who don't give a rip about God, and they act like beasts, and they the whole thing seems rebellious. And in the midst of this, God gives us this book that says every king, every ruler, every moment is under the sovereign hand of God. There's never, like, it got weird this week, right? When Sarah Huckabee Sanders got up and said, you know, God wanted the president to be president, or, you know, Donald Trump to be president. And all of a sudden, we don't know how to respond. Because the culture goes, that's weird. And the reason it's weird is because the way she said it was awful. Just so you know. But it was true. But hence you go running, the sovereignty of God also wanted Barack Obama to be president and Bill Clinton. He is the one who orchestrates history for his purpose, and every king who sits on a throne, every ruler who takes command, does so at the bidding of the sovereign God of this universe, who through their rebellion, through them acting like beasts, which is one of the big themes you'll see here, through them running from God and determining, feeling like I determine the fate of the universe, and God is proving because their time is short. And their sovereignty is limited, and it will come to an end. And so these crazy visions, they're weird, okay? I'm just warning you, this apocalyptic literature at the second half of this book, come and have fun, man. We're going to see all kinds of crazy beings and beasts and all this kind of stuff. But what each different vision of a statue, of four beasts, of different things that we'll see, each different vision is a picture of coming kingdoms. And hear me, I'm talking about coming kingdoms in the day of Daniel, because some of these things are so vivid about kingdoms that have already existed. A lot of the stuff that Daniel speaks of is in his future. It's actually in our past. And they're vivid images. But did you know that the prophet Daniel predicted the Super Bowl this week? True story. It's in the Bible. You go look it up. Daniel chapter 8. There, Daniel has this weird vision of a ram and a goat. And for those of you who don't understand the goat, like my wife didn't know what we were talking about when I explained this to her this morning, in our culture, goat is an acrostic for greatest of all time. It's right there in the Bible, a ram and a goat. The goat annihilates the ram. The goat annihilates the ram. It's in the Bible. This is prophesied. But the goat starts growing these weird horns, which my son says probably represents the number of Super Bowls that he will win. and it ends with a giant horn that we understand the Bible is the Antichrist, so we now know Tom Brady is the Antichrist. It's right there. It's in Daniel 8. Go read it. And when the Antichrist is revealed, the end is here. So this Super Bowl is proof that Christ is returning very soon. It's the only explanation we can give for that call 2 weeks ago. Those of you who don't get into football jokes, have no idea what I'm talking about, that's all right. Watch the Puppy Bowl. You'll be fine. Now, I say that in joking. You know this, right? But I will warn you that a lot of people through history have done the same kind of games with all these images. And we got to be careful of that. We're going to be very careful, but there is a central theme to all these visions. And we, looking back on it, can see the beauty of it. That Daniel, when he is making, he keeps saying, I don't know what this means. Like, literally, you will have multiple places where Daniel will see this vision, and there is this angelic figure, and Daniel goes, I don't know what this means. I don't get it. And the angel says, it's not for you. Just write it down and share it. And literally, it is that way, where Daniel's like, I went and, like, for 3 months was depressed because I saw these visions. They totally freaked me out, and nobody gave me an answer. Which means somebody who shows up with a giant chart to tell us what it means may not be hitting all the right points, okay? Just so you know, we will not have charts here. For those of you who grew up in church background where you know what I'm talking about, there you go. For those of you who didn't, just move on. Okay, so, but bottom line is that what we do see by the vivid description of rise and fall of kingdoms is this. No king who put his foot down and said, I'm sovereign, was. And the God who is sovereign of all of them is continuing to fly his flag. And one day, we will see it clearly. But tomorrow morning, we just have to believe it. We just have to believe it. God is sovereign over kingdoms. But it also is revealing, Daniel is revealing to us as we see his interaction with these four Hebrew men and with his people as a whole, this nation that is the Hebrew people living in exile, who feel like our God is lost. In fact, there's something very interesting in the text. I want you to see this. Verse 2 is really interesting because it starts with this. We have the fall of Jehoiakim the king and the transport of these men, these leaders. Look what verse 2 says. And the Lord gave. The text does not say, and Nebuchadnezzar asserted his power over these people, and they were deported, and Jehoiakim lost. It says, the Lord gave Jehoiakim into the hands of Nebuchadnezzar. The Lord gave. But look what Nebuchadnezzar does. He marches into the temple and grabs some of the objects of the worship of Yahweh, the one true living God that is in the Bible, and he brings them back, and he puts those objects that were used in the worship of God into the temple of his God. In Shinar, which is a very interesting place. If you became a student of the Bible and you went back to the very early pages of Scripture, you would realize that the land of Shinar is in modern-day Iraq. It is the seat of power for the Babylonian Empire, but it is also the place where the Tower of Babel takes place, where man looks at God and says, we don't need you, we can get to you, and they start building a tower, and God disrupts everything. Babylon becomes in the Bible from that point on not just a picture of a sitting empire, it becomes an image of regimes and rulers who set themselves up and say, God, there's no God, I'm God. And when they start doing that, they will become beasts. And so the visions are full of beasts, but in the midst of this, here are the Hebrew people, and it's reminding them that everything that is happening to you, while it feels out of control and it feels like somebody else commands it, God cares for you, he is for you, and there is something purposeful in your life. And the kings of this world will claim, I've beaten your God, and he is bowing to me. Don't buy into it. Your situation, the place you are right now, is purposeful, and God is doing something beautiful for and in you in this. But it starts with this. This is the theme all the way through, that no matter where you are, you have to wake up in the morning and go, my God is the true king. He governs kingdoms, and he has orchestrated the events of my life for his glory and my good. And I trust that today. Because what will happen is the growing hostility towards Christianity, if it does happen here like I think it's going to, we will feel like the culture is sovereign, and it will cause us to feel like the only way we can survive is to cater, to give in. And what we need to do is we need to wake up and go, they are not sovereign. God is doing something for me and in me. And so if we live that way, what Daniel's going to teach us, okay? What Daniel's going to teach us is that God is already always sovereignly doing three things in you and me as individuals in this world, okay? Three things that God is always doing sovereignly. We'll see this in the story as we go forward. You can see it in the text that we're reading today in snippets, and we'll see this going forward. We need to realize that when I wake up this morning, I realize that God is sovereign in his work that is in me, in you, in us. That the events of my life, the struggles that I have, that having cancer or a bad boss or a tough situation, or to have to write a paper that I am wrestling with my beliefs, or if I am in a situation where I have somebody who will fail me because I believe what I believe, or if I have a situation where family members are fighting me and will ostracize me because I hold on to my beliefs, all this are true in people, that I need to realize that God is always using those moments in me, and he is at work doing something real and beautiful in me. For the Hebrew people as a nation, this was a time of discipline. They had fallen into awful idolatry that led to horrible activity. Listen, they were sacrificing children to the gods of Canaan. They were literally, like, they would conquer, they would have a battle, they would rip women from, this is God's people, the Hebrew, but they're following the way the other nations are doing it, but they became so much worse. They were literally having moments where they would defeat a village, they would kill all the men, they would pull all the women and use them as sex slaves. They would get them pregnant and then throw the babies on coals as an offering to the foreign gods. This is the people who God redeemed in the Old Testament. This is the baloney they were doing. And God said, enough. There's no more remedy for these people. I must act as a good father and discipline them and get this out of them because it's their destruction. They're awful. That's what God does. And it's for their good. Just like, you know, you ever had that conversation with a parent, this hurts me more than it hurts you when you spank them? That's a lie, just so you know. My dad used to say that to me. Not true. I've never said that to my children because I know it does not hurt me more than it hurts you. But I do know I can look at my children and say, listen, when I'm disciplining you, it's not pleasant, but it is for your good. That's what God's doing in them. And sometimes the hardship in life is God's loving discipline to help us stay connected and devoted to him because he is the only one who can give us hope. Heard from a person in our church this week who has been through an awful season of life that involves a lot of physical, literally physical pain to a level that was unbelievable. Like awful, awful pain, and found out that the doctors didn't really misdiagnose, but they didn't catch some things about it and ended up in a situation where the pain was actually a sign of something that was going on that could have killed him. And they kind of didn't understand that. And so then they figured out things were going really bad. And in the end, and so here's this guy who's like the suffering, physical suffering he went through for 2 or 3 weeks was awful. And I went and saw him and he was glowing. Because this is what he says. I was hurting really bad, but I met God there. And I feel so close to the Lord through my pain. Listen, your moment is God's sovereign, like, you're not going to wake up tomorrow morning and have a day that God went, oops, didn't see that coming. Tomorrow morning you're going to wake up in a day and everything that happens in that day is going to be God's sovereign purpose in you. And sometimes we say, well, what about, like I sin. Part of the reason I'm going through this is because of the stupid stuff I do. So is the Old Testament people of God. They got to Babylon because of their sin, and it doesn't mean that God was not sovereign. He was orchestrating the events of their life for his glory, for their good, and he even used their brokenness to take the gospel to Babylon. Right? We are now going to have a transplant of people in Babylon. It is their failure that led them there, and now Daniel and Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego are going to stand before the king of the sitting empire and make the gospel known. Something through us. God is also, the sovereignty of God also shows his work not only in us but through us. And that's what I just alluded to, that now they are images, pictures of the one true and living God in Babylon. This is what God is doing with you and with me. In the midst of a world that gets darker and more hardened towards what we believe, the more the gospel transforms us, the more we're going to look drastically different. And God is putting representations of his glory in this culture. And so if you're here today and you're not a follower of Jesus, you've probably come across people who were awful pictures of the true and living God. They were spiteful. They were hateful. They didn't like justice. They didn't stand for things that mattered. They were always fighting for their own power. I'm just letting you know that that is not what authentic Christianity looks like. Authentic Christianity looks like Jesus in a world that wanted to kill him. And he loved them and served them and gave himself to them anyway. Right? Come on, right? That's what authentic faith in Jesus is going to look like. And so this is what God is going to do in Babylon. And we're going to see a lot of that sort of stuff coming out in Daniel. And we also see God's work, the sovereignty of God's work for us. Daniel is a book about the gospel. It is a picture of exile. And the ultimate exile is Jesus, who was left his home in glory and stepped into a world that despised him and hated him and rejected him. And in the midst of this, Jesus' exile, his exile, is redemptive, that he ultimately is killed because of who he was. And we think that the Roman government at that time and the Jewish leaders, they look sovereign in the moment, don't they? But it was God's plan all along to have Christ die for our sins. He became an exile for you and me, and his exile is redemptive. The picture of exile in the Bible, in Daniel, the picture of exile in my life is a reminder that God is sovereign over it, and he is redemptive through it, and that God is leading us back to Christ, who is the ultimate exile. And that what happens is then, therefore, the message of Daniel, if we don't see this first, we're going to turn Daniel into a bunch of superhero stories where they become our example instead of being reminded that the central issue is this, that the gospel proves that God is sovereign over every circumstance because God was sovereign over the cross. And he brought the resurrection out of it. And your redemption and my redemption. And the same is going to be true as Daniel and his friends live their lives in Babylon. And it's the same is true for us, that we're going to have to figure out how to live as exiles. We're going to have to figure that out. People all over the world now who claim Jesus already know what it's like. Are we prepared for this? And are we figuring this out? And it all begins with this. There are going to be days where your problems, your struggle, your boss, your teacher, your family will feel like they are sovereign. Like they control everything in the world. And it's at those moments where we more and more need a book of Daniel that says, it's temporary. It's short. And so as the band comes up here, I'm going to close with this. I'm going to close with the final words. Another book of apocalyptic literature, which we'll explain what that means later in the series. The book of Revelation. And in the final words of the Bible, Revelation chapter 21, we need this vision to live as exiles. So just hear this. We're not going to put it on screen. I just want you for a minute, just where you're at, close your eyes and listen to this vivid image that is the final image in the Bible. Then I saw a new heaven and a new earth, for the first heaven and first earth had passed away. The sea was no more, and I saw the holy city, New Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God, prepared as a bride, adorned for her husband. And I heard a loud voice from the throne saying, behold, the dwelling place of God is with man. He will dwell with them, and they will be his people. God himself will be with them as their God. He will wipe away every tear from their eyes. Death shall be no more. Neither shall there be mourning, nor crying, nor pain anymore, for the former things have passed away. What are the former things? All the kingdoms, the struggles, the things of this world. And he who was seated on the throne said, behold, I am making all things new. And also he said, write this down, for these words are trustworthy and they are true. He said to me, it is done. I am the Alpha and the Omega, the beginning and the end. To the thirsty, I will give from the spring of water of life without payment. The one who conquers will have this heritage, and I will be his God, and he will be my true son or daughter. Lord, we thank you for the message of the Bible that reminds us that our hope is not in how well we stand, but how sovereign you are. Give us a vision of your sovereignty, of your absolute control over both kingdoms of this world and in a micro version in the events of my life. And help us to realize that everything you were doing for the world in the world is to accomplish your purpose, to demonstrate your glory, and it's for our good. And so, Lord, help us to apply what that means to our job tomorrow, and our place in the culture, and to love our city like you loved it. In your name I pray. Amen.